Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business Brew. We got a very special guest this week, Jen Ross, Rocket Jen Ross, if I may. Rocket science, short seller extraordinaire, political commentator, and everything in between. As a reminder, this is not investment advice. Do not follow anything that we're saying. We are two people hanging out late on a Friday night. I'm drinking wine. Jen's got something in her hand. Don't take any of this too seriously, but I hope you enjoy us along this ride. Nothing's investment advice. We're not your fiduciaries. You know the drill. Do your own due diligence. Jen, how you doing?
Very good, Bill. I like your safe harbor statement because
it's super vetted.
Well, whoever would listen to a short seller is out of their mind anyway. So
that's possible. I tend to like you guys. I think you have something weird in you that makes you short sell, but we can get into that.
Oh, I definitely do. Yeah.
Well, and not just you. Like, I mean, I think I fell in love with short selling. I was at a Grants conference and Mark Cahotas walked up on stage with this Canadian jacket and he proceeded to just completely dismantle whatever entity. What was it? Home Capital Group? I think it was Home Capital Group. And just the passion that I watched him deliver that speech and then started to like follow him on Twitter. I mean, that dude has got a different gear. That is not the same game as being long and hoping that interest rates go down.
No, I mean, short sellers read everything. We read the 10Qs, the 10Ks, every single footnote, every article. I remember, I don't know if it was Ramp Capital or one of those guys, but they said something like, if Tesla Q only applied that skill set to any other stock, like they would be millionaires.
Yeah. I mean, so what is it that makes you want to be like, if you did that amount of long research, you'd by far do the most due diligence on the street, right? Like, what is it about short sellers that are doing that kind of level of, it's almost a crusade.
We're very idealistic to a fault, I think, right? I think the last year or two has proved that, you know, it's funny. I fell into my own traps where I would always say, if your thesis requires a government agency to do their job, abandon it now. But in the same sense, I'm like, well, the SEC is not going to let Robinhood run in front of trades. They're not going to let Tesla, you know, go ahead and fake a leveraged buyout. But they did, right? And so I think our idealism sometimes gets in our way, which means you have to be very good about holding on to your risk rules because you can just blow yourself up very quickly with unlimited risk. So you have to have rules in place that are there to keep you from falling into your emotions or falling into your ego. But yeah, I mean, the short sellers that I know are extremely smart. They're idealistic. They're actually very optimistic because if you're a short seller and you're pessimistic, you're going to take on way too much risk because you're always going to think that the world is falling apart. So most of the short sellers I know are super funny, quick-witted, and they have a way of finding information and connecting dots that are like second and third order effects, where if you took information individually, it's just data points. But when they weave it together, you get a whole holistic view that can really tip you off to the true nature of the business. Hmm. And, you know, not every short is a fraud, but it's very helpful when you are shorting frauds to be able to do that kind of critical thinking.
Yeah, but then again, you told me that only crazy people short frauds.
Oh, yeah, I know a lot of short sellers that won't touch frauds. Frauds are by far the most fun. I mean, the stories, like, you know, like people are coming out with Penn now where the guy's like photoshopping his face on fake material or, you know, like we've talked about with Tesla. That's going to be a case study for generations someday. And it's by far the most fun. Martin Shkreli, to, you know, we've seen CEOs of frauds like murder their spouses. It's just stuff that if you saw in a Hollywood movie, you would never think is real.
That's an easy thing to not be long. I don't know about shorting. Yeah. Why is it so hard to short frauds?
Well, Chanos says it best where he talks about this one book. I can't remember the author's name, but it's called The Seven Signs of Ethical Collapse. And in these seven signs, you know, one of them is it's almost like a CEO with a cult-like following and the sheep will suspend disbelief, right? Hmm. Whether it be Enron having, you know, Ken Lay having his following to, you know, some of the companies that we see today. So shorts So also with fraud, you don't always see it in the income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow statement. You usually see it in the qualitative stuff first. Like Martin Scorelli was committing fraud at Retrofin, and that's why he's in prison. And a So he blew up a hedge fund prior to founding Retrofin and taking it public. And when you looked at his financials, you didn't really see anything quite off, but then you started to look at like what products were they selling? Well, they're selling oxytocin and ketamine, right? So it was like a weird variety of drugs. And then you look to see, well, he IPO'd with Roth Capital. They're a bullshit bank compared to Goldman Sachs and others. He had a no-name auditor that was easily fleeced. And then you go into social media and it was like a total shit show, right? Where he's hitting on women and like just saying gross stuff. And then he had all these fake Twitter accounts. So you look at it and you're like, all right, this doesn't make sense. And then you start to look through the 10Q and you see he's charging 6 Bloomberg terminals. And you're like, why would a pharmaceutical company be charging Bloomberg terminals? And so he was still trying to run a fund inside of Retrofin. And then he blew up his last fund. So in order to pay back those investors, he was having them like send in invoices for like consulting work that they were not doing. And then he was funneling the money back to them.
And what, I mean, so if you are clever enough, let's just say he's hypothetical. Let's say all these facts are true. I'm not trying to get us in a ton of trouble, but
yeah. Well, he's in prison right now.
That's
true. Know if he could do anything about it. Right?
I just haven't done my own research, so I'm not trying to come at him. So like, is the thing about shorting a fraud that that kind of person is so persuasive in selling the story that they're telling that it's hard to figure out when it cracks?
Yeah, because usually the story is fantastical, right? And you would say there's a lot of stocks right now on the market that have gone parabolic, and it's because of their story. Like either we're going to have hotels surrounding Mars to we're all going to be eating vegetable-based protein to electric cars, right? So there's always this fantastical story around these larger-than-life stories, even things like Theranos, where she was saying, well, you can test in one drop of blood, you know, all these different diseases, right? And the physics didn't make sense. So it's always innovation like no other, where you have the believers. So it always becomes like a religion to the believers, right? So you try to say, well, no, there's science there that says that that's just not fundamentally possible. And the cult just says, well, the great leader says it is, right? And so you have people that will follow these stocks and follow these Silicon Valley type companies religiously. And I mean, there was a really funny, I don't know if you saw the video today. I think it was Bloomberg posted a video of a kid who said he turned $10,000 into $1 million trading Tesla.
Yeah, and Tesla, yeah.
But the math didn't make sense. I mean, how did he said that he didn't trade options. He only did it on the equity. I don't know how that math really worked, how you got from 10,000 to a million. But he's a perfect symbol of somebody who's like, screw fundamentals and screw the true nature of the company. I believe that this, you know, this company is going to take over the world.
I'll tell you what's pretty amazing about that. And I've had opinions over time, all of which have been wrong according to the market, but $659 billion for that company today.
Oh my God.
That's incredible.
But that's the perfect point of idealism of short sellers, right? And pretty early on, I had said, like, it's not a tradable stock. It rips the faces off the longs and the shorts. But the shorts had it completely right on the fundamentals. You know, they warned, hey, we're going to have year over year revenue declines, that their only growth will be from opening up new markets, that the subsidies were going to run out, and you were going to see in those countries a decline of adoption of Teslas. There's going to be new competition coming on. All of those things came true, right? The company keeps incinerating cash in order to make the cash burn not look so bad. They don't spend as much on CapEx. So they're
No, it's gross spend, Jen. You don't understand gross spend. They're investing through the income statement and the cash flow statement.
Oh my God, don't even start with me on that. I'm like, show me on the income statement where this is. But still, the story goes on. And people will say to me, but Jen, you don't understand, you know, it's taking over the world. And I'm like, well, it's only 1% of global auto revenues. So, and that's with every subsidy ever thrown at it. So how are you telling me that this technology is taking over the world when the company was founded in the early 2000s and has only penetrated 1% of the global market. But yet you add the market cap up of its six nearest competitors and it doesn't even equal Tesla's market cap.
I think you're not thinking long enough, Jen.
I know. I have this argument every day. It's so frustrating. And it's hard because I can right fight all I want, but the stock price is making people millionaires. So I look like the idiot, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I had a dude, and if that guy's listening, thank you for listening. I'm not trying to call you out. And that's why I'm not saying your name. But this guy was like, you know, I really don't like, he actually said that he found it offensive how I talk about some of these highly valued names. And I am one of the first to admit that, like, I really don't know what the heck's going on in a lot of these SaaS names or even Tesla. Like, I can't even construct a case that you could argue is worth, right, what people think it's worth.
Well, saying I don't know what's going on is different than saying I don't know what it's worth. Like, there are obvious things that are going on, right? So those stocks are low float stocks. And last year, we started seeing this habit of someone going in, buying a large amount of out of the money calls, and then the stock would just rip up, right? So it was manipulation. We've seen it in the Shanghai market in 2015. You were seeing it last year. Some of it is like that Delta Gamma hedging style.
You buy this? This is a theory you buy?
Oh, no, I was one of the people who noticed it, who was very vocal about it. Yeah, last year, back in October, there's tweets of me saying there's some out of the money calls here that don't make much sense.
Are you talking specifically about Tesla? Or are you talking about like some of these low?
There's about eight of them that are low float Silicon Valley dream stocks, and you can watch the manipulation happen. So the question is, well, is it a nefarious foreign actor? Right. Because that was my first question, looking back to like Shanghai in 2015, you know, is this China messing around manipulating our stock market? And then it was, well,
let me ask you a quick question.
Yeah,
why would that matter? Let's say it is China manipulating the stock market. Why does that, like, if I'm just a skeptic, like, why do I even care? Right. Let's all go make money, buy calls and whatever.
So what do you think is going to happen when Tesla shits the bed?
Well, now that they're included in the S&P and they just have a Momo buyer, I'm not sure they ever will. But I don't disagree with you that there could be some negative consequences to rewarding companies like this.
Right, right.
To be fair, I have not done deep research, but I think that probably Tesla Q is more in tune with the fundamentals than the longs at this point. I'm sorry, longs.
Yeah.
I just turned off like half the people that listen.
No, but I mean, the longs tell me every day. I hear this from friends, coworkers, everyone is like, you don't understand. They're revolutionizing the world. It's the greatest innovation ever, right? So they say the fundamentals now don't matter. But I'm like, but you're using 2040 cash flows that are so obnoxious that, you know, these discounted cash flow models that don't make sense to get today's valuation. They don't care. It does not matter to them.
So, the wild thing is if you push people on that math, like what do you think the discount rate is that they have to use to make sense of today's valuation?
You can't even. You'd have to sell cars to larger than the world population, right?
And these that's why they're going to Mars.
Right. Bring your lithium ion batteries to Mars. That'll be wonderful.
But like, all right, so let's, I'm going to try to remove that particular stock just because it's so like hot button.
Right.
People's blood will probably boil. What do you do when you have a stock that is somewhat similar? And as a short seller, you have a view, but it seems to me like the whole world is incentivized again, like towards getting you to cave on that stock. Like how do you manage risk on a position like that? And then how do you know when to put it on? Because a lot of smart guys have gotten their faces blown off in that thing.
Right, right. So before you even put it in the portfolio, you have to ask yourself, like, what the problem with Tesla is the short interest was way too high, right? So it was an easy squeeze. You want to make sure the interest is not too high, that you're not going to be too much of the volume in any day, so that you want to be able to get out of the position over a week if you had to. So you got to look at the trading volume. I personally read all of the 10Qs, the 10Ks. I build historical models that go back a few years. And then I do projections for the future. And I try to do like best case, worst case projections and make sure that the future is going to be worse than the past. And then you assume, I mean, if you're assuming that the market is rational and is going to follow fundamentals, then if you can see the stock price is going to be down a certain percentage, like if you believe it's going to be down more than 50% in the next couple of years, then it makes sense to add it into the portfolio from there. Once you're in that position, though, you don't want to have a full size position off the bat because this thing could, you know, go tearing. So you you try to feed into it and pyramid into it. And then even if you have a ton of conviction, but it is getting above a certain percentage, like, you know, I think Chanos is one of those people, he has about 5% is his max size. I think we were 4%. If it starts to get above that max size, you have to cut it back. And that's painful because for me, the most painful short I ever had was Westport Innovations because that stock just took off. I knew it was total bullshit. The physics did not work. The whole, from front to end, it was like the dumbest company ever. But the rebate was like 40%. So, you know, how do you short a stock that's 40%? I remember my boss and me getting in this awful, awful argument over it because she wanted me to have conviction if we're going to hold on to it, but it mentally, the stock just abused me that I caved a little bit on that stock.
Was that because of the borrow or was that because of the price action that it like got in your head? Both.
Both. It was both. And it was like, again, it was one of those stocks, like we're all going to go to natural gas engines. And I'm like, no, we're not. Because just think about it. The size of a gas tank for natural gas would take up the whole like payload of this like truck. And you're asking truckers who have to be careful with like their costs and making sure that there's enough availability of their truck running, they're not going to take on this new technology. And natural gas also is great for like a hub and spoke type situation. You're a garbage truck and every night you're going back to the hub, but that's not cross country 18 wheelers.
Yeah.
And you just couldn't get the energy density from natural gas. I mean, it was just stupid. It was an absolutely stupid company. And I remember going to their investor days and there was just so many people that were like a religious cult over this stuff. And the stock went from like $28 to $40 and the rebate was like at 40%. And I think that was by far the toughest short to ever hold onto.
Do you remember what the enterprise value peaked at?
I don't because we got out of it. I'd have to look back. To be honest, I don't remember how big it
that
got.
That sucks. So you were right and you guys got blown out of it? Or
yeah.
Girls?
Girls,
gals?
Yeah.
What's right? What's the right terminology? I think.
Ladies? I don't know.
Yeah, you professional women.
Yes.
So that, and when we talked, you mentioned that was an all-woman hedge fund, right?
At the time, it was all female. Yeah, I think since then they've added men.
What was that like?
It was interesting. So they stay very, very private. I'm not even going to say their name because they really respect their privacy. But I think it was interesting having an all-female dynamic. I think they are by far the smartest people I've ever worked with. And I've worked in rocket science and everything. Super geniuses. And we had two women who were sniper instructors.
What?
Previously, yes. So they were like crazy tough. The other two, me and the other one, were a little more emotional here and there. So whenever we got a little too emotional, like those two were like, lock it up, right?
They brought in the snipers?
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So it was interesting. You know, I've never had a female boss before or since then. Huh. So that was a neat experience to work for another woman.
You know, it's weird, like this podcast, I get the data and whatever, and it's like 94% guys. And I wish that more women were listening, but then I think about like how many women are on the street, and it's just not that many that either I interact with or I know of or like whatever. And I don't know, one of the ways that we got connected was I said, I'd like to interview women. I still want to. If somebody's listening to this and knows a cool woman to talk to, please reach out because I think it's important.
There's a cool group of FinTwit ladies. Like we all have our little estrogen chat group. And it's funny because it's from all different parts of like some are day traders. One is running a pension fund. I mean, so it's all over the place. There's some great female venture capitalists on. I think with podcasts, it's hard. I think podcasts tend to, in general, be more males listening. Banking and investing is still a male-dominated industry.
Yeah. So. I was at a bank. I fucking hated this one woman that I worked with. But then the other side of me is like, you know, she had to grow up in a time that, you know, she was probably the only woman in an investment bank. And her viewpoint was probably like, dude, make it or like go home crying. I don't really care, right?
Yeah.
So
in order to be a female in you know, even in rocket science, you kind of have to be the best of the best to make it through. Like, no slacker female is going to make it into these very male dominated industries. So, like, at work, the females that I work with are just phenomenal, because we came up in a time where it just wasn't popular for women to be in the industry.
You had mentioned that you thought that women were slightly better at risk management.
Oh, absolutely.
So why do you think that is?
I think men are more emotionally tied to their trades than women are. I think that you guys take it a little bit personal when it doesn't work.
Where I'm very in touch with my feminine side. I'm very comfortable being wrong.
I mean, you know, this is a generalization. It's not
Thank
all
you.
Men and
Thank
all
you
women.
For,
of course. Of course.
We'll make me the exception to what we're talking about. I clearly have no flaws.
Like, if a trade is working against me, I, you know, and every time there's an earnings call, I ask myself, like, what is the thesis still holding up? Was I wrong from the beginning, or did something fundamentally change? Like, maybe a new management team came in, or maybe they did another capital raise, so it changes the story. And then you have to adjust and not be so emotionally tied. Like, you have to know when to call in your chips on it, where I think that some men will hold on to the bitter end, either because it's ego driven or they just don't want to face the music that the trade is just not going to work.
So when do you, so, all right, so let's talk about Tesla again. I know it's going to make some people upset, but like, when do you face the music, right? Because I would argue that the shorts still don't think that they're wrong, but
they traded this, out of it, right? Look at the short interest.
Yeah. So how do you, so how does that thought process go through? Like,
no one cares if you're right. No one gives a shit in life. Like, number one fundamental rule, no one gives a shit if you're right. Think about every argument you ever had where you're right. But if you're arguing like an asshole, nobody cares.
Yeah.
So being right doesn't win you any favors, doesn't win you friends, and it doesn't win you money if these things are not trading on facts.
So what are they, like, what is a stock like that, if not that one, trading on?
Religion.
Yeah.
Low float religion. There's just so much stupid money out there right now, right? The Fed is just printing money like crazy. It has nowhere to go. There's been a rise of the zombie stocks, right? I was warning you guys last year. Holy crap, look at the zombies. The worse you are, the more you burn cash. It seemed like, and the closer you were to bankruptcy, the more your stock was going parabolic.
Was that limited to, was that a shale issue, or was that just like generally, I mean, was that SaaS? What was that?
It was across, I ran those screens across US equities, but I excluded things like shale, oil, gold, mining, pharmaceuticals that are very binary. And I was just looking at like what remained. And most of the stocks, so I compared the zombies to the rest of the names that came through the screen. And in January and February of this year, those zombies were up substantially more than the general market.
I think it's because why that would be.
Why did Robinhood kids go into Hertz and JCPenney's, right? Like, they were literally bankrupt, and these kids were still trading this crap.
To be fair, though, that was after January and February. I'm not trying to, like, argue with you.
Correct.
I'm just trying to figure it out.
But the pattern started back in, like, October. So what happened? I'm still thinking that Robinhood was offering zero fees. And the big banks are like, crap, we want to capture the millennials. Why? Because millennials have more money in their savings account than the average American. As much as
really?
They complain. Oh, yeah. So it was the CIO of Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, back in January, had this dinner that I went to. And he went through all the numbers. They want the millennials because of the ESG stuff, where they'll invest in companies based on these, like, I don't want to say religion, but in terms of like this.
No, ESG is fucking bullshit. I know somebody that runs an ESG fund that I have like mad respect for. I don't want to come off like a promoter, so I'm not going to name them. But like that whole thing, if there is a perfect theme for Wall Street to package up and just sell to the masses and make fees on, it's ESG.
Like, it's total bullshit, right?
Yes,
and 100%. If you look at the companies in ESG, you're like, wait, these are lithium ion batteries, like raping the earth and cobalt mined by children. But yet it's considered, and I'm like, you're plugging this into a coal burning power plant, and it's a $100,000 toy for people in Santa Monica. But yeah, it's considered ESG, right?
I said, my one buddy does it right. At least I think he does. I haven't seen his whole book. But like, I do think there's a couple of people out there that believe in it. But man, that thing is like perfect for just pillaging people in a marketing wrapper.
Exactly. I mean, it is a beautiful marketing wrapper.
Yeah.
And
I care about the world.
Tugs, right? And it heart tugs a whole generation of people that have, like, they have on average $10,000 in their savings account, where the average American has like $600 in their savings account. Hmm. So it's a really right market. And these banks know how to market to these kids about experiences and saving the world. And so they'll package some of these stocks under that same vein, right? At the same time, they wanted to pull the kids away from Robinhood. So what do? They started offering zero fee trades. And then when you don't have to pay trading fees, you can trade in and out of this crap all day long. And so I think you saw the volatility start to go way up. And then when you had the lockdown start, oh, forget it. These kids had nowhere else to go or what to do. So there's no sports betting. So what else are you going to do? But you're going to trade in and out of Beyond Meat and Virgin Galactic, right? All day long.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that bothers me a lot about like the zero fee thing is when you look at how at least some of these firms are compensated, when you get payment for order flow, like I haven't done all the math myself, but just like optically on the back of the napkin, it seems like they get paid a lot more for option flow. Mm-hmm. And then they're also incentivized for margin debt. And it's like, okay, so if I just think about the incentives, it's basically to push people into the riskiest financial products.
And ruin their lives.
Possibly. Yeah, right?
Yeah. I mean, the last time you and me talked, we talked about this where I said, you know, the only thing that's going to bring down Robinhood is that, you know, they're obviously front-running trades, giving it to the high-frequency traders. And so they're not doing a fiduciary, you know, I don't know exactly what their fiduciary duty is to their clients, but this seems moral and ethically wrong. And I was saying, like, hey, let's see how this turns out. I don't think it's going to be good for them. The SEC will shut it down. And then instead, what does the SEC do? They slap them on the wrist with a fine, and that's about it. So a lot
we'll
of this
see.
Is complacency.
It's the beginning.
Yeah, but you know what? After seeing what the SEC has looked away from for the last couple of years, I go back to my, if you expect a government agency to do their job, abandon your thesis.
Yeah, no doubt. I will say I had a discussion with somebody today that was talking about like these 3x leverage funds and how much money they make on like the fees of when somebody holds it overnight. That's when you really get destroyed when you're holding those 3x leverage funds and like they're actually day trading vehicles. And it, you know, his point was like, I don't know that Robinhood is better or worse than that, right? But like, I also don't know where to draw the line. And I thought that was actually a fairly compelling argument. I mean, I'm obviously emotionally biased against Robinhood, I think for pretty freaking good reason.
Yeah. But is the inevitable outcome when your business is like preying on people who don't know better and is designed to make the most money when you've got these kids over leveraged. And that's the inevitable outcome. These are young kids that have no idea that they could turn this upside down really quickly.
Yeah. I mean, my biggest fear is like the kids are turning to that platform because they don't trust Wall Street. And that platform has embedded some brain hacks, which this is opinion, right? I don't have any facts to back this up. It's just my thought. But like they have embedded brain hacks that have incentivized trading. And if we have a group of young people that will graduate with a ton of debt that inherently don't trust the system and they're turning to an alternative platform that ends up screwing them, like I am really worried about the consequences.
But that is the system, right? Like you can't say they don't trust Wall Street. Well, what the hell are they doing, right? They're trading options. That is Wall Street. So to me, it's the gaming of it, where even on social media, it's the dopamine, the serotonin. It's the same kind of release you get with dating apps or how WeChat does the coin thing. There's a certain amount of human psychology and it becomes a game. And like I said, these kids are home now for how many months with nothing to do? And you've got like 15-year-olds talking about like trading in and out of stocks. So to them, it's a game. It's monopoly money that they don't even realize could get them upside down.
Well, you know, and I've had this conversation with some people, and what they said to me is like, well, a lot of these kids understand that it's Monopoly money. And if that's the case, I guess it's like more okay than maybe I would be predisposed to say. But my beef with that particular platform, from what I've understood, is it's super hard to find ETFs. And if you're going to call yourself Robinhood and democratize investing and then make it really hard to find investment products, like, right, we got to have a hard conversation before I buy your sales pitch.
Yeah, that's not about democratizing. I mean, come on, give me a break. It's about gaming. It's about turning this into a game for people.
Yeah, well, I tend to agree.
If you had 1,000 lives like you do, like, this isn't Call of Duty where I could just, like,
yeah, that's right,
you know, re-up. This is, holy crap, I'm $50,000 in debt now because I didn't realize that if I held on to this future that I'd actually be responsible for it.
Yeah, that's like when I started to trade options, I did not do it very well, but I learned on Thinkorswim from this dude, Tom Sosnoff. I really like him. He led with education first. He definitely, you know, well, I caused myself to overtrade with his knowledge. Maybe I'll say it that way. But I always felt like when I traded on their platform, and even TastyTrade that I see them do their thing now, like, they were always there. Right. I could call them. I'd have somebody on the phone right away.
Right.
And I always felt approached it in the right way. So even though I was engaging in what I knew was risky behavior, I sort of understood the risk. Hopefully.
But also,
that's
how old were you at that time?
Probably 24, which is about the worst time to take on risk as a male, because I think that's the dumbest animal on the planet.
Yeah, but it was your own money that you were earning through a paycheck, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
These are like 18-year-olds that, like, you know, Nana gave them birthday money and they're doing this stuff. So I think it's about, like, the context and understanding and the social psychology of the money. It's a lot easier to game money that you didn't, like, you know, put your blood, sweat, and tears into.
Yeah. I mean, look, my official on the record stance is I don't think that anybody should be precluded from a financial product because they don't have the wealth. I do think that there are reasons that Wall Street has been precluded from selling to unsophisticated people. And I don't know if regulation is the answer. That my bias is not to say regulation is, but if this shit continues to go on, like, something's got to fix it. And I'm just trying to be loud before the regulators come, because they're going to come. Like,
well,
there's no way
come,
this ends well.
I saw that SEC slap on the wrist. I'm like, well, no, I think the regulators are going to look the other way.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I mean, look, my belief in conservative thought is if you're going to be conservative, you got to talk up when you see that, you know, bullshit happening. And I see it happening. So I'm trying to
be somewhat reasonable
about how I'm talking about it.
But at this point, you know, I don't think, my opinion is the SEC does not want to be considered the cause of any kind of pullback or collapse. I think that's why they didn't go after Tesla with the fake leverage buyout years ago. Because
that was bizarre to me.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a couple things. First of all, the SEC wants easy cases to try. That's why they love insider trading. Because if you're going to put this in front of a jury, are you really going to talk about
a term sheet
and what it's like to actually do a leverage buyout, right? So, like, all of us could see this was fake. There was all of the process was not done. They didn't halt the stock. There was no term sheet. There was nothing that went to the board first. But try explaining that to a jury, right? The jury's not going to understand. So you want to do something. The way the SEC works is they wait till afterwards. There's something easy to show, and then they'll recreate it. But they're not proactive like the short sellers are. You know, your short sellers are your real-time investigators. And some of them are very vocal. I was not vocal when I was shorting on a position. I was the type that after it collapsed, I would take my model, my research, and put it in the mail and send it to the SEC.
Huh.
But I didn't want to be considered a manipulator, right? You know, you look at Chainos will go out there, or Cojones, or, you know, even some of the people going after Penn right now. They're being demonized as slimy short sellers, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a no-win situation.
I mean,
oh, he's freaking amazing. Donut Shorts both are just really brilliant people.
I may even know of Donut Shorts by face, but I don't know who he is, right? So the only reason that I, like, love Cojones is I've just seen that man pitch something and people shit on him or whatever because they think he's a little bit, I don't know if the word promotional or whatever. I don't know what the answer is, but when he stood up and he said, like, I'm so concentrated, it would make a lot of you sick. Like, I knew what this guy is, you know, like to be that concentrated on a short,
sure.
That dude believes in what he's saying.
Yeah,
he might
that
be wrong.
To me is insanity.
Right. Yeah. Like, and I think he would acknowledge, like, I might be wrong, but if you're going to say he's wrong, put your research up.
I never understood his overstock trade and how he got into bed with Patrick. That was the only time that Cahote's lost me. Other than that, I think that he's incredible and I'm a huge fan, but I just couldn't follow the whole overstock. And then when they got into the IOC, and then what an unusual bedfellow, right? Patrick had gone off after the shorts forever. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're chummy, and it was just, I couldn't quite follow that. And I still don't follow it to this day.
So I don't know. And Mark, please don't come after the two of us because we're not trying to get into that. I will say, though,
he doesn't know me at all, so it's fine.
What he does say, at least my belief of what he says, is that he felt the same way about that guy. And then they sort of got on a personal level and maybe that changed some stuff, but I don't really know.
Yeah, and then I think Patrick went off the deep end again. Something happened, like this whole story that he—I can't remember what really went on, but like something with the Russians and,
yeah,
and
who
Trump,
knows?
And it was like, what the hell?
Whatever.
You know?
Yeah, that's right.
So, but that was the only one of Cahote's I couldn't follow. Like the MyMedic stuff was brilliant. I think he's involved with some of this Penn stuff that's going on, uncovering that. But yeah, the overstock thing still to this day confuses me.
So, like, let's say that you see something like overstock going parabolic and you don't get it. Like, when, as a short seller, would you think about initiating? Because one thing that when I was talking to McMurtry, what I thought that he had articulated really well was, you know, you can tell the Tesla longs, like, this doesn't make sense, but they don't care, right? They're talking
right,
about
they don't
going
care.
To the moon.
Yep.
So did you used to think, okay, the story is going to crack and then we'll put on our position? Or would you think more of my fundamentals are right and I'll hold it through the borrow and whatever the pain comes, like, let's do it?
It depended on the stock. Our hedge fund had a rule, never bet against Elon. So
okay.
We had never shorted. I mean, after I left the hedge fund, I was
When was this? Do you mind talking about
so
the year? You
I
don't
left
have to.
There, I left there in 2015.
And you already had that rule?
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he was on our radar forever. Forever.
Really?
I mean, oh, God. Yeah, I mean,
from
I could go
PayPal
back.
From his PayPal days?
No, but from early days of Tesla and SolarCity. I mean, SolarCity was a shit show from top to bottom. I would put SolarCity absolutely in the fraud category of just, like, funny
things.
This is
things. All opinion for those that
for
are
opinion,
listening. I'm
yes.
not trying to
yes, for
get
opinion.
Either
it's
of
hard
us in
too,
trouble.
Because you know, I've tried to stay off of Elon's radar.
Yeah,
so
list.
I want to, because he could easily, you know, hurt me with work. But SolarCity was his cousins, so we can't blame Elon for this, right? This was the Reeves. But that company was near collapse. And yet they were out there saying, like, oh, we're just printing money and it's great and everything is fine. But yet they had certain debt instruments that were related party transactions because they were so ugly that there was nobody that was actually going to give them the money to do this. So I wanted to short SolarCity, but I couldn't get a borrow. So at that point, and I've chosen because of work reasons, I'm legally allowed to trade Tesla. I just choose not to because I think it would look bad where he could always say, hey, you've got somebody in the rocket business that's actively betting against my company.
That said, I see you on Twitter, like cheering on SpaceX. Like you are not like an Elon hater per se, right? Like you
well, the
are
thing
down
is, no
for the
human
cause
being
when it
is 100% good or 100% bad, right?
Yeah.
You know, that would be a very myopic way. I think that there's a lot of incredible things the man has done. He has reinvigorated the space program, you know, out of its darkest hours. Like when during the Obama era and we shut down the space shuttle and we could only launch our astronauts on Russian rockets, like that is shameful. Hmm. That was disgustingly shameful.
Why did we do that? Do you know?
Money. It was so freaking expensive to launch that shuttle.
Yeah.
The reusability economics, but I won't go there.
That's the hack he solved, right? That he could reuse the rockets. Is that what you're referring to or no?
I would say his hack is the ability to raise venture capital.
Well,
he
that's
can raise
pretty
money
important these days.
Right, exactly. So if your business model does not close, you have the ability to stay alive by new injections of cash. So again, there's a few things that he's phenomenal at, right? He reinvigorated the space program. I would say he hires the smartest people I've ever worked with.
Oh,
his
yeah?
engineers are phenomenal, hardworking, super smart people. They've done some great things. I mean, you saw the SNA test the other day that was just like freaking phenomenal, right? That rocket goes on its belly and then comes back vertical again. So they've done a lot of great concepts. But I think his main product is a function of today's day and age where we all put money into our 401ks every month. And that just keeps going. And we need more and more stocks to buy with that. So he can constantly dilute, keep raising, dilute, keep raising, and it makes everyone rich. We need the stocks in our ETFs and our 401ks. The bankers need the deals, right? You look from top to bottom, everybody needs this. So I think that he's discovered that his greatest gift probably is giving the masses what they need, and it's more shares, even privately. You know, if you look at the number of series of capital raises he's done.
One of the things that I was doing some math on the other night was dilution just generally, right? And I was like, all right, you know, you're in this, like a lot of these high EV to current cash flow names, right? It's like, all right, well, what do I have to believe to get to the EV today? And then I was looking at the share dilution over that time. It's like, all right, that can work for a year, but over 10 years, dilution's a real bitch.
It is. But again, people don't care because the stock price has gone so parabolic that it outpaces the dilution.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
well, even Zoom, I was looking at, and I'm not trying to pick on them, and I don't know what the average share counts are. I'm talking a little bit out of school here, but for the period ended October 31st, I think the 9 months ended. I think that the top line revenue was like 400% growth. But if you do revenue per share, I think it was 300% growth. And I know that they probably had some, you know, unique reason to issue whatever shares, but like 400, 300% is not nothing.
It's material enough that,
And it's not average. I get that I have problems with how I'm calculating it. It's
just off the top of my head.
But I'm just saying, like, maybe look at that if you're going to be a long-term shareholder, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
and if
but
the
their
stock
feeling
price-
is it's the numerator versus the denominator. So if the denominator grows, but the numerator outpaces the growth of the denominator, they don't seem to care. But the thing is, the numerator is only growing because of ultra liquidity, the whole reflexivity bubble that Soros talks about.
You think that's so?
Yes. Well, I mean, we have to look at the quality of earnings, but there's enough, the companies that seem to be outpacing the rest of the market, I would not say that they have strong quality of earnings. And so,
and why do you say that?
You can look to see, well, they have revenue growth, right? But where's that revenue growth coming? Oh, is it from coming from subsidies? Is it coming from their, you know, same store sales, or is it coming from just opening up new stores? Look at their operating margins and their net margins. And I don't think that they're very high quality earnings.
So if I'm playing devil's advocate with you, I tell you that they're investing through the income statement and underpricing to land and expand.
Yeah, but
what do you say to that?
But it depends, right? So that's great if you're Salesforce, where you can take the same software, put it on the cloud, and just grow yourself out of expenses. But if you're a capital goods company that needs to build new factories and maintain those factories, well, I don't know if that scalability story really works, right?
Yeah.
If you have to do a shit ton of R&D and you have to do a lot of CapEx to grow, I don't see yourself necessarily scaling out that way.
I'll tell you the thing that like might be the biggest blind spot. It might be costing me a lot of money, but like to your point on R&D, I just see the R&D line item grow in a lot of these companies.
As a percent of revenues or just in absolute dollars?
I would need to do a lot more work. What I can tell you is that it seems to me as though the incentive system right now is set up to reward top line growth. Mm-hmm. And because of that, the expense structure can get sort of, to my perception, of a little bit wacky. And I think that as long as the top line is growing, and many companies these days, people forgive the expenses because they say, well, they'll figure it out. And I guess
it's a beat and raise game too, we're saying, right? Like you said, it's about the top line growth, and then it's pretty much beating the estimates on the top and the bottom lines, right?
Yeah.
So some of these companies, you'll see right before earnings, they'll start like socializing, lowering of those numbers, and then they lower it so much that comes earning report, they actually beat it, or they announce on non-GAAP earnings.
Yeah.
And it confuses, I don't know if it confuses the algorithms or people just don't understand the difference, you know, but when you're telling me adjusted EBITDA, like already EBITDA is a bullshit number, and then you're adjusting it even more, and that's what you're running your press release on, to me, that's just like a beat and raise game that they're going to keep playing.
And yeah, my beef is on gross margin. I feel like there's a lot of sale. So if you think about the traditional manufacturing company, let's say I were to build out a plant, right? And when I process, I used to bank food, so let's call it chickens. As I process chickens through the manufacturing company, the depreciation runs through the gross profit.
Correct.
There are certain companies.
Some
these
in
days,
operating a little bit too, though, depending
right.
if you're vertically integrated.
Yeah,
which
no
is
doubt.
Why I don't look at gross margin. I only look at operating margin.
Yeah, well, so some of these companies today, like the SG&A is basically your plant. But people are like, oh, look at the gross margins. And it's like, well, yeah.
I don't know, that's really apples to apples. You know, that's one of the biggest arguments I have with the U.S. government when we're talking about financials. You know, they always want to talk about gross margins of a company. I'm like, who gives a shit about the gross margins? They're a vertically integrated company.
Huh. So why does the government care about gross margins?
Because I think that's the way they've always done it with their contracts. Like there's the federal acquisition regulations. And so a lot of it's like, well, you know, a contractor can't make more than 12% over cost, right?
Yeah, this is what TransDigm got in trouble for.
Yes, exactly, right? But they're looking at the wrong line sometimes, in my opinion, because you're now dealing with vendors that are vertically integrated. So you're... To me, I always look at the operating margin because it's your operating profit that makes your debt payments.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly asked, okay, is this industrial-based partner going to go bankrupt? Well, what that means to me is, can they service their debt and can they pay their vendors? And I use the operating margin line to look for that.
Yeah. Well, that's like fully baked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how much are you allowed to talk about your rocket science job?
I can talk a little bit. I didn't go through CorpCom on this, so I don't want to talk too much. But I left the hedge fund in 2015, and I switched over to federally funded think tank. And we support right now it's the U.S. Space Force. It was the U.S. Air Force and the National Reconnaissance Office space programs. And I was hired originally into a group of like engineers with MBAs doing this kind of analysis of the markets, our industrial base. And then after a couple of years, I switched over and decided to do flight operations for National Security Space Launch. So I sit console on launches. I have a team of engineers that I reach back to make sure something we call like, is the telemetry going to come off the rocket? Are the ground stations all,
right.
all over the world?
Explain this to a two-year-old. Is the telemetry going to come off
the
rocket?
There's a bunch of data that comes off the rocket. We're constantly reading all points of data that we want to get from the rocket as it's circling the Earth. But that data has to beam down to ground stations all around the Earth to receive it. So I have to make sure that those ground stations are going to come online and can receive that data, especially during critical parts of the rocket launch.
Are they in the ocean?
They're on islands in the ocean. Yeah, there's definitely some on islands all over the world. So you can watch it during a rocket launch just all over the world.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm
hear,
very
like,
stupid when we're talking about this. So I didn't know if it was like all in on the mainland and we're like collecting or if it's all throughout the world.
No, there's some in Guam, Hawaii, like they're all over, right? Huh. Because this rocket is circling the Earth. And so you need to have stations all over. So we double check to make sure that during critical events that there's a ground station that's going to be able to receive this data. Another thing that fell under flight operations is like the second stage that was pushing the satellite or the payload into orbit, that eventually separates from the payload and typically comes back down to Earth and lands in the ocean. Sometimes it's left in space, but so we made sure that it was going to land in a part of the ocean where there's no population. We're on the phone with the FAA to make sure that ships and planes do not enter that area.
How the hell do you land in this job? Like what goes on in Jen's life that she's like, I'm done with short selling. I'm going to rocket launching.
How could you not be done with short selling in this market, right?
I mean, I get it. I understand why you quit one. I don't understand how you ended up in the other.
So I think part of it was I was doing a lot of financial analysis for our rocket group. So some of it was so that I could keep doing financial analysis. I mean, there's a number of rocket vendors. Small launch is mostly privately funded through angel investors and venture capital. A lot of people don't know how to analyze venture class companies, so I was able to work on that. And then even with our larger primes, you have some that are private companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX, and then you have some that are joint ventures of larger parents, like United Launch Alliance is a JV of Boeing and Lockheed. So, and then there was Northrop Grumman. So you have to span the ability to analyze a publicly traded company that gives you quarterly financials to a private company that gives you no information. And how do you...
Because why? You're worried about like credit risk or the ability to execute. You don't want to commit to something with a company that's not going to be there. I mean, is that kind of what's going on?
Right? Yeah, that makes sense. It's partly due diligence. It's partly our job at this think tank is to do mission assurance. We look and identify risks to the system. And we have a tendency to concentrate on the hardware risks, but the risk to some of these systems are not the hardware. It's the ability to raise capital of the money's business, right? So it's just part of that situational awareness to understand what's going on in our industrial base. And
do you ever get conflicted that the amount of liquidity almost enables some of your job, but it's also what you hate as a short seller?
Yes. I mean, it's really funny. It's true.
Internal conflict.
Yes, absolutely. Right. It's like, all right, I know that there's 140 small launch companies mainly because there's so much liquidity right now.
So what do you think about that? Do you think that there's a legitimacy to the argument that the amount of liquidity and low rates creates sort of, you know, technology of the future? Or do you think it's a lot of malinvestment?
You know, there's that valley of death, right? And so if this liquidity helps great technologies get through that valley of death out to the other side, well, okay, then you could say it was worth it. But if it's just to be a misallocation of capital and create bubbles for crap that like pets.com that's going to go under and no one ever actually gave a shit about it, well, you know, that was definitely a waste of investor money. So it's hard to say until you're on the other side of it. Right? Yeah. Even there's 140 companies, there'll be a few that make it out. And those could be game changing, whether it be for our warfighters or even for the commercial market to have these new capabilities. But there'll be 137 that just die.
So what are, like, as a noob citizen, what am I trying to look for in the space sector? Like, am I looking for really fast flights to Japan, or like, is America going to, what's not classified that you can tell me about what we're doing up there?
So this will be kind of hard for me to answer because I didn't.
You don't have to
talk to work about it, but
we can also just cancel this. I can edit all this out.
Well, what I would say is there's people who would be great guests to talk about this exact topic.
Okay.
I would say Ethan Petrasky at Venrock and Josh Wolf at Lux Capital.
Okay, we're going to go back on the record right now. I'm going to ask you officially, what is Space Force?
So Space Force started out, there was a portion of the Air Force that was dedicated to space. Out in Colorado Springs, it was headquartered as Air Force Space Command. But there are a few issues that were happening. One, the Air Force is mostly air breathers. It was very difficult to make a career in space. Predominantly, the budget went to the air breathing part of the Space Force.
What do you mean by air breathing?
Like the planes, right? Okay. The guys who are fighter pilots, right? You're going to be a general, you're going to be a fighter pilot.
Okay.
Where it was very hard, I think, to make a career in space, especially if you wanted to move up to like a general type position. Earlier on, you know, we were the bells of the ball up in space, but in the last few years, our near peer opponents have become more aggressive. Their technologies have grown in capability. So it is becoming congested and contested up there. And it was becoming clear that we needed to be able to protect and fight into and through space as a domain. So there's a component of it, like there's a war fighting component of it. We want to be able to protect our assets up there, the assets of our allies. And then also there's a cyber component to the Space Force. You know,
What's the cyber component?
We have a lot of people inside the Space Force that work on preventing cyber hacks and preventing cyber warfare.
That makes sense.
Yeah, a lot of that falls under the Space Force. It's hard because cyber goes cross-domain, right? Every part of the combatant commands need cyber, but a large component of it does fall under the Space Force.
it's weird because I see like a lot of, I don't know what, I have no idea what space does as a company or whatever. And I'm like, why are so many people so interested in space? On the other hand, I guess there's like good reason. I don't know. It seems like a lot of capital is flowing to that industry.
Well, I mean,
or at least the stocks already are moving quick.
Yeah. I mean, for a long time, you know, Adam Jonas recently, I think it was last December at his space conference, went to all the bankers. It was, you know, it was a space conference and said, how important is space to your portfolio? Like, raise your hand if space is important. And I think like 1 out of 10 people raised their hand. And then he reminded them of the statistic that's very true. So GPS, Global Positioning System, is really giving us position, navigation, and timing. And that timing component is extremely important for all parts of our infrastructure and communications networking. It runs our ATM machines. It runs part of the smart grids. It runs the dams, like an insane amount of our infrastructure. If PNT went down, if GPS went down, it would cost the U.S. economy between $1 and $1.5 billion per day. But it's so ubiquitous, you have no idea, right?
Yeah, you just assume it's going to work.
Right. And so much of the capabilities we get from our satellites are just part of an integrated system that you don't realize that it's a node that if that was to go down and that if there wasn't another satellite to pick up that slack, that we would have some serious problems in our own economy and vulnerabilities.
Do you buy the argument of internet through space?
You know, I think that any business that wants to be from space, the moat has to be space. Meaning if you can do it terrestrially, it's usually cheaper to do it terrestrially and it's easier to do tech refresh terrestrially, right? So they're going to be competing against the 5G here on Earth, and then they're not going to have the same issues with like speed and latency, right? So we talk about wanting to use your cell phone anywhere and wanting to use internet anywhere. Well, that's great if you're hiking the mountains and you can connect to a satellite, but you really want to be able to use your cell phone internet from like a parking garage. And that's not going to work, right, with a satellite system. So I think that the marketing for some of these systems for internet doesn't really match the reality where, you know, we're talking about using internet anywhere. Well, you're not out in an oil rig most of the time, but you are in a parking garage. So is it really internet anywhere? Like sometimes you're providing capabilities that aren't a huge customer base. So then it's going to come down to, can you get the economics to close so that those who are underserved, right, the people in remote areas, the people who don't have fiber running, that they could use these capabilities? And usually space is expensive. So you're going to have to find other ways to close the business model.
That's what it seems to me, because it seems to me as though you're competing against people that already have a dense network that works. So you can try to introduce a different technology as long as you got the patience to get through the burn, but I don't know that you can get to critical mass. That seems hard to me.
Yeah, so I don't think they're going to be commercial businesses. I think that they'll have a large defense component, right? Mm-hmm. Defense tends to be high ARPU. The Pentagon's willing to pay a higher revenue than a commercial customer would. Once you get a defense customer, it's stickier, right? And so I would think that most of those commercial constellations will be either subsidized through the FCC and then have, you know, government customers that could help subsidize some of these commercial costs.
So like putting your short seller hat on, how do you think through a nascent technology like this that people are saying, okay, the internet's going to come from space. How do you think through like, when might I short something like this? Is it worth a short? What's your process start like? And then how do you narrow it down to the decision process?
Okay.
Does that question make sense?
Yes, but I'm going to use it very generic because this is a little bit of a conflict with my job.
Okay, that's fair.
But I'll use it.
I'm just thinking of a new technology.
Right, a nascent technology, right? So then you look at, you know, you've got the total addressable market bros out there. They're going to tell you this is the TAM. And so what I try to do is
TAM bros are the best bros. EV to TAM.
Exactly.
I love the TAM bros. Shout out to you all.
Shout out to the West Coast there. So what I usually try to look at is who is doing something similar now, if there is something similar. Like you've got Viasat out there and you've got Inmarsat, Intelsat. And so
is Iridium still relevant?
Yeah. I mean, Iridium's still launching. I think SpaceX just finished off launching their constellation, you know, their refresh. But you start to look to see, okay, what was the art of the possible for them? and you look to see what were their max commercial revenues. Well, some of them were about max $500 million, right? They penetrated the airlines, they penetrated the oil rigs and the remote areas. And when they were up and running full constellation, they got around $500 million. So then I start to compare that to what the total addressable market bros are saying. And I'm like, okay, what does it take to close that business model to be cash flow positive, or at least cash flow break even? And, you know, if it's a couple billion dollars of revenues, and I know at most they can only make a few hundred million, then I say, where does the differential come from? Can they penetrate defense markets or governments, you know, global governments to make up that difference? Hmm. And then I look for certain things that they can do to bring down their costs that maybe will close the business model so that you can get cash flow positive. So I look for, you know, those critical paths. What's the most expensive part? Is it going to be the life cycle of the satellite? Is it going to be the terminal cost? How cheap does a terminal have to be? Because you have to give those out, right, to your customers. So in order for this business model to close, can it be a $3,000 terminal? Probably not. Can it be a $500 terminal? Well, yeah, maybe customers will start to pay that fee. Well, what do I need to do to get it from $3,000 to $500? And yeah, is that possible? Well, it could be possible through certain technologies, or it could be possible through capturing certain subsidies. And so those are the ways that I try to see if you can close the business model.
What do you do when the Tambros heap a huge EV on a concept that you think doesn't have like this huge? So like you'll look at some things, let's just say for the sake of argument, that has this huge enterprise value, but you think that the actual economics are pretty crappy. And I know that I've asked this question a couple different ways, but like, how do you decide when to put on that short? The thing that's so tough for me to understand about you short sellers is the guys that are long or the girls that are long have time on their side. And like, y'all have to pay borrow. Mm-hmm. And there's so many institutional biases, for lack of a better term, that are like, you're swimming upstream. So how do you figure out how to put on a position?
Yeah, you're swimming against the ocean, right? So yeah, for us, like, I want to be sure, I want to truly convince myself through data-driven analysis that the stock will be down 50% within the next 1 to 2 years.
But how do you know if the Tambros control the flow?
Well, I mean, it's been worse in the last few years, obviously, because of the liquidity issue. But some of the shorts have still worked, right?
Yeah.
So, and some of them were frauds and some of them weren't. I mean, you have to also look what type of short it is. Is it a buggy whip company, right? Is it a Yellow Pages? Is it a, you know, an Electronic World
or movie theater right now?
Yeah, right. And so, and then, you know, does it have any possibility of pivoting or coming back? And for me, the number one indicator is the management team. If there's a really great short that I love as a short, but they bring in a new management team that has the ability to turn it around, then I might exit the short just on that. Hmm. There's times though where, like, JCPenney's was a perfect example where
Short Ackman?
Oh yes.
Oh, how dare you short Ackman?
And the only time I met Ackman was at JCPenney's headquarters, and I will never forget this day. Like, this was one of my favorite days ever.
He's so good looking, and he was in retail, and you shorted him.
I shorted him, and it was so tasty, this short, because it was the one time where I looked around, and I'm not one of those like, oh my God, you have to have a 50-50 mix of female executives on your board kind of thing. But it was one of those moments where I looked all around and go, holy shit, not one single woman walked through this store with these guys, okay?
Not good on retail.
No, it was so bad. So they got Ron Johnson from Apple, and he thought he was just going to replicate an Apple store. So his big idea was this whole mall within a mall.
Yep.
Mind you, malls were dying, so why would you want this mall within a mall concept? But you walk in, and it was polished white crap everywhere, right? In a store that sells polyester, right? So it's this like, so he decided without any research to get rid of coupons.
Yeah, that's the part that I didn't like.
And there was no research done behind that. They just decided, yeah, and they wanted to go after a more selective customer. But the selective customers are brand snobs. Mm-hmm. So like, they won't pivot immediately to JCPenney's, right? And we went into the store. They did this whole dog and pony show where you met at the headquarters, and then they put us on these buses to one of the stores. Polished white everywhere. The store within a store concept was there was a dry cleaners in the store. And this is when I was standing next to Ackman at this point. And I go, I just want to let you guys know, I don't even schlep across the street to drop off my dry cleaning. I sure as hell am not driving to the mall
to JCPenney
to drop off to JCPenney's, a store that doesn't sell dry cleaned clothes, right? Like, nothing you buy at JCPenney's needs to be dry cleaned, first of all.
Were they going to do it for free, or was it just like
No, it was just like...
Oh, they were going to charge?
Yeah, it was a mall within a mall.
Oh,
right?
That's very stupid.
But this is crap that I don't want to go to the mall for to begin with. There's a reason
Bill
why
Ackman,
it's not at the mall.
If you listen, come on, bro. What'd you do?
Yeah, so then we're walking around more, and he's like, well, we got rid of registers. And all I could think of is, like, trying to buy a bunch of, say you've got a bunch of kids and you got heavy back to school jackets in your arms and you're running around the store trying to find somebody with an iPad to scan this shit. I was like, that is not going to work. Then they had next to the children's section, a gelato store. Now, mind you, this is a polished white store. And all I could imagine is tiny little chocolate fingerprints all over the merchandise. So like every part of this thing just made no sense to me. And it was one of those times where I couldn't bite my tongue. And I, you know, even as a short so I looked over and I was like, this from top to bottom, this is a horrible idea. As a female shopper, there is no way I would go to the store for this stuff. And they just kind of rolled their eyes like, who the hell are you? And this was the time when the share was about $40 a share. So I remember calling back to the fund like halfway through this pitch day, like, make this our biggest position. I'm like, this is a shit show. And then I remember one of the guys who's now one of my best friends I met that day, because I remember sitting on the bus next to him and I was like, can you believe this crap? And you saw like the color drain from his face where he was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, this is so bad. I'm like, not only is their balance sheet a shit show, but the management team is like driving into the ground. And then I remember the woman from Goldman Sachs who like gave him a loan was at our table. And she could like hear us talking, and I could tell she was having heart palpitations. But yeah, that was the only time I met Bill Ackman, and I tried to give him a piece of advice and got blown off. So I think it was a big position for us.
I'm on the record as a Bill Ackman liker, so a lot of people don't like that.
He did great this
year. JCPenney did not.
Or Herbalife or half the other stuff. But it's amazing how concentrated he can make his position.
That's how the right tail works. So you can mess up on half if you're right on the big winners.
Yeah,
it doesn't
and
really
he's
matter
really
so
right
much.
On the big winners, right? And
yeah.
He's got a lot of smart friends that I really respect. Like Lynn Tung, I think, is just an awesome guy. And they say that I'm a little harsh about that moment. But it's just a really funny memory of again, arrogance, not letting you realize that, like, hey, maybe you're making a bad choice here with this redesign of the store. And maybe, I don't know, bring some of your female execs with you next time. And they can tell you that how bad of an idea this is.
I didn't ever see this store, but what I thought that they really messed up on was when I heard that they weren't going to discount anymore. That made me super nervous, right? Because then you have a situation where like your core customer, you're invalidating your proposition to them. And
well,
that-
their website, right? Their website was one of the most top 10 e-commerce websites at the time, and they killed it by getting rid of coupons. So
yeah,
like the shining
crazy.
Gem of JCPenney's, they killed in one fail swoop.
That's what people hate on Bed Bath & Beyond for, but it's like, that's also what their customers expect. So I don't know what they can't go away from couponing. That's who they are.
You've already conditioned the customer for it. There's no unconditioning them at this point.
Yeah.
And
that
it's not like Bed Bath
&
Beyond sells the stuff super cheap. I mean, I feel like sometimes when I go in there with my coupon, it's equivalent to what I would have paid elsewhere.
Yeah, but you think you're getting a deal.
Yeah. Well, it's that human psychology, right? It's the gaming, the thinking that I'm losing money not buying this, right?
Yeah. The CEO change has been interesting. I haven't been in there in a while, mostly because COVID hit. But
yeah.
I
Where
do
are you
think
getting your Yankee candles from if you're not going into Bed Bath & Beyond?
Oh, you know what? I don't have enough Yankee candles around here. That's my problem.
Your
I'm buying my
cups?
Wine on the internet, though.
Nice.
I should be getting them on QVC, given how loud I've been about that position.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, well.
Like Ackman with Chipotle.
That's right. Yeah, I should be taking pictures. I was taking pictures of QVC for a minute, but I should continue that. So, oh, well. Transitioning.
Yes.
My highlight, my strength is transitions. Information flow. You and I had talked about how you read the news. And I had shared a story about how when I was at a table once upon a time, the smartest guy there wasn't focused at all on the story, and he was focused on who leaked the story and why. Mm-hmm. How do you view the news, and how has short selling sort of skewed your perception of corporate puffery, for lack of a better term?
Well, you know, all information is biased, right? It's biased from the person who's giving the information, and even we are biased receiving it through our lens. So I'm a believer that put all information out there, like don't hide information from me, but I want to calibrate for it. So that's why it is important when I get a research report or I read a news article, who wrote it? What are their biases? How are they paid, right? Even if it's like a CEO and I want to find fraud, how are they paid? That's where I'm going to go find it. So then I try to caveat when I'm reading this. And if it's a super glowing review of a company where I'm like, all right, well, are they trying to do a secondary with this company? Or are there other reasons why they might be a little more optimistic on it? And so I'm not calling them a liar. I just think that they have, you know, some biases there that just need to be calibrated. So when every piece of information, I ask myself, like, okay, where did this come from? What is that person's motivation? Is it true, right? Do I agree with this? And if I don't agree with this, could I be wrong? Are there other things that I should take a look at? And even if it's true, does it matter? Sometimes, especially when you're dealing with frauds, a lot of times when you're interviewing a CEO or a CFO that's lying to you, they won't outright lie. Instead, they use this technique of answering your question with a correct, true statement completely irrelevant to the question you asked. Hmm. And it's almost like a mental platitude where they'll say it and it sounds right and you kind of rest on it and you're like, you know, it is what it is kind of thing. And then you move on to the next topic because there's this, again, this psychology where it's like if they say something that's correct, even if it wasn't the answer to the right question, maybe I don't fully understand. So I'll move on to the next thing. And I see that a lot with fraudulent executives where they'll answer, they don't lie. It's just what they're saying is totally irrelevant to what's being asked.
Hmm. You know, what's been on my head lately is like there's these CEOs that write nice letters. And I have, you know, there was this, not like a narrative. I mean, it was supported by data, but that for a while, clear corporate communication resulted in higher stockholder returns, right? But
yes.
Then I have sort of like dug into a couple companies that have written this letter that you might think like, oh, this is the best letter ever. And then you look at what the stock has done or what the business has done, and it's really corporate marketing, for lack of a better term.
Correct. So that's an indication where you want to go through the letter and ask yourself, well, why are they saying this? Is it true? And does it matter?
Yeah.
And so that's a perfect example when you want to try to apply that kind of reasoning to the information.
What do you think of Buffett?
You know, I'm not a value investor.
I'm just asking you what you think of how he communicates with his shareholders.
Oh, yeah, his like 80-page letters. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think, again, there's a cult around that. Like, we all get excited.
I'm part of it. Right, I am a cult member.
And that's why I'm asking. I read his letters. I enjoy them. I learn something from them. Do I always agree with them? No, but they're still enjoyable and they're still an interesting perspective, right? So I think he's a unique one with his letters that like you get really excited to go read them. And
so as like a skeptic, do you buy sort of the, you know, grandpa sales pitch or do you
read it with a highly skeptical eye? He has a track record. He's been able to find good companies, right? And hold them for a long time. And, you know, they're cash flowing companies. And so it's not that I don't buy him. I just don't want to have conflicting methodologies, right? And so you can have a diversified portfolio, but I'm not going to try to run a hedge fund that's like Buffett style long and then short tech bros, because those would be like somewhat inconsistent. I would run a short fund maybe that does distressed debt, something that would be a good match. And
so you would pair up like a Buffett style long strategy with like just a dumpster fire short strategy.
Yeah. I guess, what do you mean by a dumpster fire short strategy?
I don't know. You said like you wouldn't short the tech bros.
Well, I don't think I would pair them with any kind of like, it's like what you're trying to do as an individual investor in your portfolio. And why would you in that type of portfolio take on such risk as short selling? Because it's a hedge, right? And so do you need to hedge I'm going to invest in blue chips and See's Candy kind of like dividend paying cash flow, super stable companies? Well, I don't think that a concentrated short position actually hedges that properly.
So do you run your PA with shorts?
My personal account? No. No, I have no reason to. I'm not wealthy enough to need that kind of hedge. I got divorced. There's no wealth after divorce.
That's fair. The lawyers may need the hedges.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, no. So I don't have enough in my personal account to really justify needing that type of hedge. Now, I want to keep my skills sharp. So do I still run screens and read 10Qs and 10Ks and just do it for the academic fun of it? Hell yeah. And that's why I tweet some of this stuff. I mean, I helped a friend co-write an article on benefit focus last year on Seeking Alpha, just because I find it intriguing. And I never want to lose that skill set or lose that, yeah, that ability, because I can apply it to other areas of my job now.
That's interesting.
But no, I'm like an ETF bro. Like, I'm like your typical long-term 401k type, you know. And then my personal account,
Tesla,
like,
now, if you're long the S&P ETF.
For the S&P. But I cannot trade aerospace and defense stock individually. Yeah. I personally choose to not trade related party companies. So I don't trade Amazon because of Blue Origin, and yeah, I don't trade Tesla because of SpaceX.
But if you're in an ETF, you just
ETFs are different because that's passive, right?
Oh, I'm aware. Yeah. I'm just telling you, you own some.
Well, I mean, that's interesting right now. Like, what's going to happen to Tesla shares now that you can't do these out of the money calls that, you know, because it's no longer going to be a low float stock. So people are going to have to start buying up Tesla shares right now to balance the ETFs. But after that, how are you going to do these parabolic pumps if you can't do these out of the money calls?
Who's doing the parabolic pump? That's the question.
Well, I think it was, well, that was the question for a while there. I thought maybe it was like overseas nefarious actors, but now I'm just thinking it was the Robin Hood traders a little bit, and then the bankers caught on themselves and started doing it with larger amounts of money. Because if it was working for the Robin Hood bros, think about if you could actually put some real money behind it. You know, I don't know, like SoftBank, I have really no idea. I'm curious to know if we'll ever find out who were doing those out of the money calls.
So now that it's in the ETF, you can't do a similar strategy. I mean, part of my ignorance. I just don't think about this stuff often.
Right? So if it's not a low float, I don't think that the trick will work anymore.
And why is that? Do they have to issue shares to get in the ETF?
I'm sorry, I sound like an idiot. He's doing like, he just did a $5 billion raise when he thought he was going to get into the ETF last time. And then he's going to do, I thought he's doing another $5 billion right now capital raise for Tesla.
It's pretty smart of him.
Yeah, it's brilliant, right? Like I said, I'm not an Elon hater. I think that his product is different than EVs. I think it's more shares for ETFs, but he capitalized on something that others didn't.
It's weird for me to see a car company with that kind of valuation and then also believe in efficient markets.
I don't believe in efficient markets anymore. I don't think this is capitalism.
What do you think's going on?
I think that we've had a period of a decade of ultra low interest rates, creating an asset bubbles, especially in real estate and equity market, that cannot handle the least bit of bad news, right? Because look back at 2018. All of a sudden, we had our Secretary of the Treasury go right before Christmas, called all the big banks. They told me there was no liquidity issue. And all of a sudden it was like, what the hell are you talking about? No one thought there was a liquidity issue. Where the hell did that come
from?
That
was a really weird statement of him.
Correct. And I think he was talking about the repo market, because shortly after that, the Fed, which has no mandate to bail out hedge funds, said, you know what? Instead of the repo market, we're going to try to lend directly to the hedge funds. And it was like, well, why would you need to do that? You have no mandate to be doing that. So the repo market was totally screwed up. And why did the liquidity dry up? I'm not sure. I mean, there's people smarter than me. China has a lot to do with the liquidity market of the repo. Were they trying to retaliate for trade reasons? I have no idea. Or were they running into their own economic issues? But I still believe they made those comments because of the repo market. Because at the time, nobody else was seeing a liquidity issue.
Yeah, that was, I don't know. I was sitting at home and I read that statement. I said, that's not even on my radar, which I'm not like the most brilliant person in the world, but that I pay some attention to stuff. And I was like, this is a bizarre statement.
Right. And then the market started to pull back. And what did we do? Right. We started like printing again. So we've gotten to a point where we will not let the market correct. And I think, I don't know. I mean, I assume it's because they're worried that if they let it correct, that it's just going to come crashing down at once. Because if it's not trading on fundamentals, what is going to hold it from crashing down further? Like, what is the safety net there? And what does it spark? Like, what is the black swan going to be? For so long, I thought the black swan was going to be all the debt in the Permian Basin, right?
Yeah.
We've become an oil nation. Shale economics doesn't close. You need, you know, oil to be above $40 a barrel just to break even. And those companies down there are very, very indebted. And it's junk debt for a lot of them, $2 trillion worth of it. So I always was like, hey, if our market starts collapsing, the government better start issuing like 0% government-backed paper to keep this Permian Basin from collapsing.
So my boy that worked down there, he says that the thing that Wall Street misses is that a lot of the game down there is not even about cash flow, right? It's about flipping to like Chevron and Occidental and whatnot. You think there's any merit in that some people are looking at these shale companies that are uneconomic, but not understanding that they're just playing like a proven sell game? Or do you think that fundamentally the wells don't work, even at scale?
I think even at scale, fundamentally the economics doesn't work. Yeah. I mean, flipping it to Chevron. Okay. So you're talking about trading futures and then on the 22nd of the month, sending the oil over to Chevron.
No, he's talking about what they would do is they would find where Chevron is buying acreage, right? And then they would say, okay, if we go buy 50 acres or whatever in front of them, and then we can prove that we have good acreage and then sell it to them. And then they're a scale producer, so they can come in and prove it out or actually produce it. They have the scale on a per barrel basis where, like, if you were looking at our financials, it may look closer to like this growth cash flow negative company, but we're not really
uneconomic. You got to still service this debt, right? Okay,
great. Just roll it, Jen. Come on. Who needs to service it?
That's exactly the black swan. It's to the point where you can't keep rolling it. Like, that's my exact point, where if you're not a cash flowing business, the moment liquidity stops for your business for some reason, you're totally effed because you still have to make those debt payments.
Yeah.
And it's $2 trillion worth of debt down there, right? So that to me is a huge worry. And you saw it. I mean, come on. Look back in March. When the market started to pull back really hard, that was not COVID, because COVID had yet not truly shut us down. We did not see any earnings statements yet. That was because Putin and Saudi Arabia came to the table. I think Putin was trying to destabilize the Saudi royal family and said, F you, I am not cutting back production. They both said F you to each other. And then the price of oil just came like shattering down. And that's what brought down the market. I think it was March 7th, 8th, around there. That was the Saudi-Russian oil pricing war that put us in the middle, because we're the world's largest oil exporter with all this debt down in the Permian Basin. So we keep calling it COVID.
There was quite an overlap, though, Jen.
What's that?
There was quite an overlap.
In March 8th? Yeah. There was panic, but to drop the market that much? I would say no, because look at the price of crude and how the market, you know, comes
back.
No,
crude got crazy.
Crude got crazy. The market got worse, right? And then they came back together.
Yeah.
I would not say this market right now is trading on COVID. It's trading on crude being back above $40 a barrel.
You think that's true?
Well,
I mean, you just said it, so I assume you think it's true.
Well, I think
just,
it's true
that's
because,
not how I've thought about it.
I haven't seen my office desk in 8 months, right?
Yeah.
There's suppliers all over the country saying my mom and pop shop is about to go under.
Yeah.
Yeah, our market's at all-time highs, but yet the market pulled back in March. And the only difference in March was oil shit the bed. And yet right now we have businesses being cut. We have a transfer of wealth from one part of the economy to the big box stores, or to just, you know, to those few companies. Everybody else is suffering. The local economies are suffering. Small business, restaurants, you know, we've been shut down, but yet our stock market's at all-time high right now. So the only difference between now and March, well, COVID got worse, but yet our stock market got better, but also crude got better. So I still think it's more to do with oil than it even does with COVID.
I'm a pushback on you on that, only in that I don't have the data in front of me, and people that I've talked to about you say that you know your shit, so I might be the idiot here.
Well, no, I mean, these are all opinions, because they'll say, well, since then also, the Fed has done a bond buying program, right? And so they've been—
rates are lower.
Rates are lower, bonds. I also think the Fed was buying equities, because there's about 9 stocks that just were not allowed to drop, right? Whether it be Amazon.
Shout out to QTR. I hope Chris Irons listens to this.
Yeah, he's awesome. But I mean, you know, look, like NVIDIA to Tesla to Amazon to Adobe were just not allowed to drop. So yes, there's a certain component of it that is definitely the Fed just injecting liquidity and supporting winners and losers. But I also think that for me, the biggest sign to get back into the market was the oil price.
I think that on the Adobe thing, at least, right, and Microsoft, when March, I think it was March 7th or March 8th, to be honest, 8th, I was long banks and airlines. So coming into that was real fun. Yeah, yeah, great, great stuff. I think by the 12th, I was out of both.
Did you get cruise ships too?
No, I didn't have the trifecta. But I did sell out of a lot of those, and I went into, I bought Microsoft and Visa and one other. And my theory was, I just want to buy something that can survive. And I think I was a little early on that trade, because they started to rip not that long after I did that. And I sort of think it was one of these flight to safety type trades.
Yeah.
I don't know that I buy that the Fed came in. That seems far-fetched. I'm not trying to argue with you. I'm just trying to tell you what I think.
People have put graphs up on Twitter and elsewhere showing different banks' holdings of these like 9 stocks. And every quarter they were just like unloading these stocks. And then all of a sudden they started to go big time. And I can understand Microsoft because, I can send you some stuff that others have sent me showing me.
We're going to go down a conspiracy rabbit hole. I love
get
this.
Get Alex Jones, you know, get him on the phone.
Well, I need a fact checker if I'm having him. I'm not trying to get deplatformed.
But I mean, there's stocks that you can tell were supported in the NASDAQ, because the NASDAQ was falling harder than the other indices back in March. I think that people were spooked, and I think it got support. It definitely got support from these banks. Now, was it the Fed telling them to support this? Was it Fed injecting money? I don't know, but it does not seem... Okay, Microsoft, I can understand some of the trade. It's a stable company. On top of it, it came out with Microsoft Teams very heavily. That was, you know, a COVID play, you could say. But some of the others, like Tesla, like, again, I hate to go back to that company, but these are toys for people who have the extra income to have a second toy car, right? And you're going to trade that up in this kind of market?
It bottomed on the 20th. I don't know. I'll tell you what I missed. I missed when the Fed announced and the government announced what they were going to do. I should have bought the shit out of everything that was super levered.
I missed it too. I got out early. I got out before early March. Like, thank God I did. But I didn't get back in time.
Were you short going into that?
No, I didn't short, but PA. But I was long, and then I decided, I think I've shown you some of my emails, like back in February, I was like, the zombies have so disconnected from the market that this does not smell right. Like, there's something very obviously wrong here.
There is something that I feel like is messed up, and I don't know how to articulate it other than I think that if you look at, and I know that this is like, people are going to roast me for saying this, but if you look at these graphs of some of these companies and how parabolic they've gone, this idea that like this is rational, it's just so hard for me to buy.
No, it's not rational. I mean, listen, the fanboys of these companies that have gone parabolic tell me, I just don't understand. It's all about the future. And I'm like, all right, well, walk me through this, right? Like, tell me, in the future, how many tickets do they have to sell to that tourism ride? Or how many cars do they need to sell to get to that valuation? And then the theory starts to break down.
Or licenses, you know.
Whatever it is. SaaS licenses or whatever. It just doesn't work. But those won't work in this ultra liquid 0% interest rate environment, because zombies stay alive through new injections of capital. And when debt is so cheap, and it's so easy, right? You can SPAC anything right now. You could SPAC your grandmother at this point, and it will get like a ridiculous valuation, right? Like Nana's chocolate chip cookies.
I don't know what people would value her at. I value her very highly. Yes. I love you if you're listening.
But, you know, like, come on. Most of the companies SPACing are like 1 month away from bankruptcy, in a sense, where you're just like, this is such horseshit. But they live another day. So if you have, it all comes down to liquidity. So I'm going to look for what would cause liquidity to tighten.
Yeah.
You know, and there was an issue with the repo market and the funds couldn't get overnight, you know, loans essentially. Well, that was a problem, but the Fed said, well, we'll step in, right? We have no mandate to support hedge funds, but we'll still do it. In this environment, I don't think it's killing the bears because the government will step in whenever they need to.
Yeah, well, I was actually having this conversation with my buddy today. He said, what do you think the optimal leverage is to have on a company? And, you know, I mean, obviously that's like super hard. It depends on the quality of the cash flow. But I said, I would push it as hard as humanly possible because in my mind, we are all playing this like debt roll game. And we've been shown that there's no scenario that I can fathom other than the system breaking. Which in which case, like, too much debt is not your biggest worry, even if it is the cause.
Yeah, at that point, you've got social unrest. I mean, like, right? But we thought the same thing in 2007, right? We fed ourselves a bunch of bullshit where we said, okay, people are not going to default on their mortgage because it's their home they're going to live in. And then you got all the Robin Hood bros of those days were the house flippers. And they just over-leveraged and over-leveraged because debt was easy to... At that time, we considered it cheap debt, right? It was like 4% interest, but it was still cheap mortgages compared to our parents that had back in the 70s, right? Double-digit percent interest rates on their mortgage. And they over-leveraged. And then finally, there was a snap in the system, just came crumbling down. So is this that same thing? Is this 2007, but instead of it being... homes? Is it more just like these parabolic equities? At this point, you know, and I think it was Chanos who said on Hidden Forces or one of those, or Hedgeye, I think, he said, Tesla is the bellwether stock of the market. And he's absolutely right, right? Where I don't think, barring any kind of insanity, right? Like any outlier one-off from the management team or the company, there's no reason for this stock to collapse. Unless the market as a whole collapses. And then I think it's going to be a negative feedback loop because it is such a big part now in terms of market cap of the S&P 500. But I don't see any massive event taking it down.
Isn't it close? It's like close to Facebook's market cap. That's stupid.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter until one day there's going to be some reverberation of this, you know, something's going to snap it. And then we're all going to look back and go, well, yeah, that was kind of dumb of us, wasn't it? Right. Just like we do with the subprime mortgages. Oh, it was kind of stupid of us to give people who had horrible credit ratings and probably not enough income, these high interest mortgages, and then let other people lever up to flip homes. Right. Like it looks really stupid. And then you had the credit default swaps. And like looking back, we look like freaking morons. Right. But when we're in it, we're all making money. Nobody gives a shit. And so that's today. We're in this reflexivity bubble. We have 0% interest rates. Nobody cares. We're all getting rich. And then...
value investors aren't getting rich, to be fair.
No, but they become SPAC bros, right? The value investors now are the biggest SPAC bros out there.
Some of the real OGs are not. They're just sitting there and sucking their thumbs, crying.
No, but look, Ackman, Tilson...
I'm friends with a lot of them.
Yeah. I mean, those guys have pivoted.
Whitney, come on, man. Stop your newsletter. Anyway, I digress.
I was going to bring up his newsletter before, but then I remembered you're a value guy.
That just hurts me. I used to like what he did. I mean, I still do like what he did. I just don't like what he's become. But
well,
whatever.
You know,
he can come on this podcast. I'll debate him.
That's the idealism, right? Like, we might not like what they do and we don't agree with it on a fundamental level with the market, but they're the ones making money. So at what point do we say, well, like, when do we say we are the religious cult? At what point do I say me reading a 10Q is a religious cult?
Look, I mean, my beef is if you're going to go down, this is probably my detriment. Like, this is who I am to a detriment. I would rather go down being honest than, like, make a bunch of money selling out.
You sound like a short seller.
Yeah, I might be.
Like to any one of us who looks at some of these stocks and it's like, well, the math is on my side, right? The math is on my side with these shorts. And even the qualitative evidence is on my side, but it doesn't matter because as long as they have access to capital, they survive.
I sometimes wonder with these stocks that go parabolic, like I do, I've read a lot. Well, I haven't read a lot of Soros, right? But I've like read some, and I do think that there's like this element of reflexivity. Mm-hmm. And if I was running some of these companies, if I put myself in the CEO seat and everybody is rewarding me for growth and they really don't care about my expenses, I'd do the same thing.
Well, look at the proxy statements, right? So again, we said it earlier. If you, you know, people do what you measure, not what you expect. So if you're going to pay a CEO based on market cap and adjusted EBITDA, well, they're going to run their business to maximize market cap and adjusted EBITDA.
So yeah, or sales growth or
whatever that is, right? You could go to the proxy statement, you can see how the CEO is paid, and then you can figure out how they're going to run the business.
Yeah.
And that's what they're being, we're literally telling them as shareholders, that's how we're going to incentivize you.
Yeah, it's a weird world. I don't know. And then when you get these things that are like valued so far out in the future, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's something I've struggled with for a while. I'm just the idiot in the room, right? I'm the guy that waits for QVC to get cheap. So what do I know?
Well, I'm the idiot. I mean, I'm very public about some of this stuff. You've seen my Twitter. I'm public with it. You know, out in the open about this doesn't make sense. This doesn't smell right. And this is going to come collapsing down. But at some point you sound like Chicken Little, because I've been saying this since what, 2015, and yeah, it's now 2020 and I got my ass handed to me.
Like, you know, the thing that bothers me is the argument, well, the stocks worked.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, I don't really give a shit.
Like, but you got to remember, these people have never touched a 10Q in their life. Right. So, you know, I hear like, oh, you know, you sound like a Tesla Q bro. Look how stupid you guys are. And I'm like, no, we were completely right on the fundamentals. Completely right. Like, we predicted everything except for the stock price.
Well, and the capital raise. He pulled off, I think, no matter how, what you are.
Oh, I predicted that capital raise. That was the difference between me and Tesla Q. I could still remember,
even at that value, like, that was a good move of
his. He pulled it out. That was the, and he admits it. If you listen to Musk, he said, I was days away from bankruptcy during that Model 3 push. And I remember Ross Gerber invited me to Santa, because I lived in Venice. He said, come over to Santa Monica. I'm going to give you a ride in my Tesla and let's talk. And so, you know, I said, Ross, the fundamentals of this company are just terrible. What are you doing? And he's like, oh, they can raise capital. They can raise capital. And I sat there and I was like, you know, he's actually right. They can raise capital right now. Bally Gifford will give it to them. Morgan Stanley will give it to them. And within, I think he was with, like, the company was within 24 hours of bankruptcy. I mean, when you look back at that one pivoting capital raise, it was weird. He hates short sellers, but yeah, he raises all this convertible debt that does nothing but create short sellers, because that's the hedge to the convertible debt.
Can you explain that to those that are less sophisticated, such as myself?
So the way convertible debt works is, like, you're essentially loaning money to the company, and they can either pay that back in cash, or it's almost like an option where they could say, okay, in this date in 2 years from now, if the share price is at $380 a share, instead of paying you back in the dollars, we could pay you back in the shares. Mm-hmm. So you always run the risk that the stock, they can't pay back the cash. And on top of it, the stock won't be valued that much. So you can start to hedge it through shorting the shares, so that in case they try to negotiate and, like, hand you cheap shares to close the deal, to pay you back, right? So say, like, I have no money, I can't pay you back the shares, then you can close your short position with the shitty shares that they gave you. So in a way, because your short position, the way that it works is you're not
responsible. But how many shares are they going to give you? They're going to settle up with that equivalent amount of shares?
Probably. I mean,
Depending on the agreement, right?
And there was a point where it looked like Tesla was going to be in that situation, right? Because right before that, they did the 420, I'm going to take it private, right? And that happened because the stock was in the 200s at the time. It was nowhere near the 380 strike price. So they had to pump it up to the strike price. But there was it was complicated, because there was a rule in there that said it had to be above 380 for, like, the last 30 trading days or something in order to qualify to give back the shares. So a lot of short sellers speculated that the 420 tweet happened because of a convertible debt that was coming due.
Yeah.
And it was the only way. What's that?
That I did see. Yeah. That theory.
So there's one way you, as a, if you're holding the convertible debt, you can hedge it through shorting the equity just in case you don't get the debt paid.
The convertibles, I was following Restoration Hardware. I got scared out of that. I had read it wrong and I thought that they could settle in shares. And then a smart man, I think it was PFH Capital, pointed out where I was wrong. And I don't know, shit, I wish I had just held on to those because anything that had liquidity concerns has ripped.
Yeah, because there are no liquidity concerns in this environment, yeah. Right? And when Musk raised that pivotal capital, it was very bizarre. It was game over. It was definitely game over for Tesla Q because they at that point had too much cash on the balance sheet to be considered, you know, a bankruptcy risk. So it was a valuation short at that point. Because it wasn't a bankruptcy risk anymore.
So that's what had you, if you had your short seller hat on,
oh, I would have gone bankruptcy. Out that
yeah. And then once it becomes a valuation short, you're done.
Yeah. Because I don't short valuation.
Yeah. Especially on a cult.
Oh, yeah. How do you do that? Right. So it had way too much cash on the balance sheet. And it was getting to the point where shortly after that, it wouldn't even show up on my screens anymore because it had enough operating margin. Now, whether you believed it or not is different because they can capitalize some stuff and put it on the balance sheet, but they had enough operating margin to make their debt payments. So it wouldn't have shown up on the type of screens that I run for shorts.
So when you're talking about, I want something to be down 50%, you're looking at like solvency risk.
Correct. I'm looking, can they pay their vendors? Can they pay their debt servicing? So I look at the cap stack. When is it due? Are they going to be able to recapitalize this? Are revenues growing? Are declining? Are margins compressing? Are they burning cash? If they're burning cash, when are they going to be out of cash? Right. And so you have to kind of look to say, how dire is this situation going to be and when and what can they do about it, right? Like, what are their options at that point?
You know what's somewhat tough, I would think, tough for short sellers is there's like no covenants left anymore in these debt packages.
Well, even if there's covenants, right? So say you're a bank and you've got debt covenants, but your company is breaking them. Well, you're immediately going to send them into bankruptcy if you exercise that, right? So a lot of banks will negotiate on the debt covenants because they don't want to be the ones to send the company into bankruptcy. So I look at covenants and I'm like, all right, you know, because a lot of times they're EBITDA based or whatever, but I don't hold a lot of stock in it because the bank's still going to negotiate that. They don't want to be the ones.
So liquidity is what you're more interested in?
Yeah.
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 That's what we always used to look at the bank.
But at this
there's
point,
your inside answer.
Yeah. Right. And at this point, what doesn't have access to capital? Because if you don't have access to capital, what do? You SPAC, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm a very defeatist short seller in this moment. But that kind of makes me feel like if I am this down and depressed about short selling, it's always darkest before the dawn. So
ask some value investors.
You know,
there's been no dawn.
Right. That's the thing. Ever since 2012, right? It's just been on a tear. So I don't know. But when you've got value investors and short sellers, like, you know, again, Chanos said the other day, I think it was Bloomberg that asked him, if you met Musk, what would you say? And he said, job well done. You know, like you got through this, and he even cut back his position. And so at that point, you're like, there's no shorting. It's just unended amounts of liquidity available.
Well, it'll stop when it stops. I think this is the Bitcoin bull thesis right here.
That's the thing I think about constantly is like, what is going to make it stop?
I don't know.
Because the money printers can keep going, right? So is it going to be political based where someone else comes in and says, well, this is not the kind of monetary policy I want to have? Is it something with China? Like they have an onshore and offshore currency and something goes wrong, or because it wasn't a global virus that put it into it, right? You would think like, okay, a one-off event, I don't know, a global pandemic. Well, that didn't show shit to the market to pull it back, maybe for March. But again, I still relate that to oil. So where is the liquidity going to stop?
I don't know. I'm going to have to put some data together on this oil theory. I think I don't disagree with you that it was definitely a contributing factor, and you seem to be smarter than me, so
no,
I'm
going
to have to think about this.
Oh, I'm sure 90% of your listeners are not going to agree with me.
Yeah, but that's fine. I don't care what
people
think.
Care either. I mean, that's why I wouldn't say it if I cared, but
But I mean, the people that I reached out to about you, they all have like mad respect for you. A lot of the listeners would have mad respect for them. And what they said is like, she's very data driven and scientific. So, you know, that was pretty much my research, right? Is confirming you with like three different people and they all had high things to say about
you.
So
I appreciate that.
I could really care less if you're like a super contrarian, but I just.
Well, let's talk about data for a second, right? Because one of the things that I struggle with at work is I work in a very quantitative environment. If you can't show it in an Excel spreadsheet, no one will listen to you. You have to be able to show it in an Excel spreadsheet. And what I remind people with a lot of the frauds and the shorts is I see it in the qualitative stuff way before I see it in the quantitative. So we have to do a better job of building more holistic models that incorporate qualitative information. Yeah. Like I said earlier, why would I get out of a short right away? The management team. I've seen ugly balance sheets and a management team, a really good management team, turn it around.
Yeah, well, this is McMurtry said a great management team running into a dumpster fire is a great signal to him. And I think he's right.
I 100% think he's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Enough of a signal for me to get out of a short.
How much would you do like personal research on the management team when you were full-blown short seller? Did you guys hire like personal detectives and stuff?
No, we didn't do anything creepy, but I would meet with the management team. I would call. So I used to first call investor relations and be friendly and talk to them, but try to ask them a question that stumped them hard enough that they had to go to the CFO for the answer. And I would be like, well, since it's complicated, can I talk to the CFO? And then I would get on the phone with the CFO and ask some questions and say, hey, you know, I'm going to be in your area in a few weeks. Can I stop by? And they, you know, would usually let me. And I would bring a second person with me typically. Sometimes it wasn't even from our own fund. It would be, you know, one of us watching body language, another person asking questions. And so I would almost always try to meet with the management team when possible. Because, you know, sometimes they might have a good answer and it would convince me to not short the company. Right. But usually it confirmed my thesis because they had a shitty answer and weird ass body language. Right.
Like,
you know, smoking cigarettes in the middle of the interview or whatever. I would try to understand the products, like Visalis used to sell this bullshit diet shake powder crap. So I would go to their like little white parties and, you know, go to their marketing pitches and really try to understand the product and the pyramid scheme itself and how it was working. So I would walk JCPenney stores all over the country to try to get a feel of like what's going on inside the stores and the traffic. So I didn't hire personal detectives. I always felt like that was a little sleazy. Plus, it doesn't help me with my own. I want my own research, right? I want to know what's going on. But I would definitely try to do as much in person as I possibly could. I would go to social media because there's a lot of red flags. You know, like I said, with Martin Shkreli, he was doing some weird shit on social media. That was a red flag for me.
Dude likes attention.
Yeah. And there's other CEOs out there that do some weird stuff on Twitter.
Yeah.
Well, we shall not.
Probably a decent yellow flag.
Yeah. So, you know, so there's qualitative indicators out there. There's companies that we would visit. There was one that was pretending to do home remodeling after Hurricane Katrina, but you went there and there was like people pretending to paint, but there was like no paint on their nails and no paint on their smocks. And like the Home Depot price tag was still on the paintbrush. So there was like, you know, you see stuff like that, or you walk into a headquarters and there's like over the top expensive art all over the place and like water features or just, you know, flamboyantly like over the top dress CEO. Their name would be on a stadium, a ballpark stadium is usually a red flag. The biggest red flag for me of all things when I'm shorting and like I get giddy when I see it in a statement is related party transactions. They overwhelmingly have been an indicator for me of nefarious problems. And there's different types, right? It could be Newman putting his wife on the board or an executive, to the CEO owning all of the real estate and the companies paying him the fees for headquarters. I overwhelmingly find companies with those types of related party transactions committing fraud.
So if you were researching along, would that be a hard stop for you?
Yeah, probably.
Really?
Unless there's a really good reason for that related party transaction, it would be a hard stop for me.
That's interesting.
Only because so many times I've seen it. Like, I would like, you know, if your listeners are out there and they are long a company that they believe is properly using related party transactions, I would like to learn about them. Because it would be contrarian to my thesis on related party transactions.
I can't think of any off the top of my head. I will tell you that, like, if John Malone did anything, I'd probably give him the benefit of the doubt. And that's probably to my detriment, right? But it's honest.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's trustworthy people out there. But then you start to ask, well, why do you need to name your family member to the board of trustees? Or why do you need to make your family member the CFO and you're the CEO? Or why do you need to sell your own assets to a publicly traded company?
John Malone does have a son on the board of something. So
yeah, but you know,
don't come at liberty. Don't do it.
But again, it's the lack of checks and balances, right? Where, you know, you're more likely to cover for your spouse than you would just an unrelated party.
I don't know. I need to think about this because this is interesting to me. Like, I, you know, I mean, I think about my portfolio. A lot of it is with Buffett and Malone. And, you know, there's, it's very possible that I have this glaring blind spot. I put a lot in their track record and I've seen them a couple times, a couple being like five or six. And I think I can read them, but like, what do you actually know? I don't know.
Yeah. But when you're talking about like Buffett, maybe putting a family member on a board, that's like a board seat for oversight like any other fund would have on there. I'm talking more about you're the CEO of a company and you have your cousin as the chairman of the board, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
That's the lack of checks and balances that I'm talking about. Not so much like I'm an investor.
I
name
my
and
kid
I have,
after Buffett, so I'm like a super fanboy.
Yeah, but Buffett is not running, like Buffett is different. He's an investor overseeing, right? Like he's putting somebody in there that would be no different than, hey, I'm investing in this company and I get two board seats, right? I'm talking more about the lack of fiduciary duty when you have two C-suite members that are related, right?
Yeah.
So there's no checks and balances, or you have board members related to the CEO, right? There's that's, to me, that should not be allowed at all.
Yeah,
I don't understand like why that's allowed, but we do allow it. I can think of companies that actually have that situation.
Well, Burford had that, right? And they went from a compounder company to short real quick.
Yeah. I would like to run, you know, maybe I'll run some screens. I think in CapIQ, I can look for, I can run screens on who has related party transactions. And then let's see, let's go through those and see if there's anything interesting there.
I would enjoy this project. We should do that.
Yeah, because to me, I get giddy. Like when I say giddy, I get giddy when I see related party transactions.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Massive you ever look at a National Beverage?
No. No, I know what, I know what you're talking about, but no, I haven't researched them. That
I've made a fair amount of money fading short reports, but I also am always super nervous. I will tell you when I've done it, I have done a lot more research than I otherwise would. I have like mad respect for short sellers. That's why when we met and you're like, I gotta tell you, I'm a, you know, a bad short seller or whatever. Like I like short sellers. Yeah, I like them.
Well,
I think it's important for the market. I just think it's sort of sad that a lot of them have thrown in the towel.
Yeah. I mean, short sellers play a very important role, right? We keep the market honest.
Calling out bullshit is necessary.
Absolutely.
Like that is fundamental to capitalism in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the rational part of the market, right? And a lot of short sellers do a shit ton of work and don't, they just share it for free, right?
Yeah.
I mean, look at the stuff Carson Block has put out there about Luck and Coffee and, you know, Chano's had with Wirecard and others like you're seeing now with Cahotes and Penn and MyMedics. Like, they didn't get paid from people reading that. Like they just openly shared it. Now, I really respect some short sellers. Some short reports I've read where I think that they're not being nefarious, but they're a little overzealous in their analysis.
Yeah.
So there's some that I kind of take with a grain of salt. And then there's a couple where I'm just like, oh, I don't even bother reading their bullshit. Right.
I'd almost like to know how long the average short seller holds the position, right? Because like, if you're like a 3 month short seller, then I would really discount your work. Somebody did a short report on Ubiquity with Robert Pera
years ago, and, right?
Wasn't
it? Yeah. I remember that short report.
I mean, that's one I made a lot of money off of. And like, I know why people didn't like him, but when he responded, the shorts were like, you can't attack the shorts. You can't attack the shorts. But when you really listen to what he said, he was like, I got to go to work and I don't have time for this stuff.
So really attacking the shorts is a red flag though. So it depends how you attack the shorts. Right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think he has an interpersonal issue that people don't vibe with. I don't think like his personality is one that the market accepts. So I think his version of saying like, I'm going to work, did not jive with what people wanted him to say. And they interpreted it as he's attacking the shorts. And I don't think that's what he's doing.
Yeah, I have to go back and see what he wrote. I mean, that was a good short back then. I think this was like 2013. You're talking about 2014.
Yeah, maybe 15 or
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
It worked until it didn't. He destroyed people on that thing.
Right. But if you treated it right,
he's a monster.
You did okay. So, yeah. So there's times that somebody could just be misinterpreted. But then there's other times where, you know, like Apple's one of the most shorted stocks at times because it could be a valuation short. And I never hear Timmy Apple talking about the short sellers, right?
Tim
like
Apple.
He just shows up and goes to work. But then
you've
got Patrick from Overstock. And
so what you just said, if any short seller is listening to this and gives two craps about what I'm going to say, I sometimes think that people are so hungry for the bait of their attacking the short sellers that they're not actually listening to what the guy is saying. And I think that happened with Ubiquity.
Yeah, and it might have in that case. I'm not saying every time a CEO says something. But there's saying something professionally, like here and there, is one thing. But sending short shorts or, suing short sellers, right? Like, that gets a little nutty.
Yeah, and you're like, no doubt.
All right, something is not. And so I have a presentation I can send you on red flags that I look for. And it's got the quotes in there from Al Dunlop. And from
Chainsaw Al?
Yes. He attacked people in his comments. And you got Ken Lay calling somebody on an earnings call an asshole. I mean, earnings call behavior is a massive red flag when it goes astray.
Huh.
And it's usually an indication that the person's under a lot of stress, right? And that
Undisciplined.
Or
maybe.
Undisciplined. They're circling the drain. I call it the caged rat syndrome, where they know they're in trouble, their back's against the wall. And then you have a short seller going, excuse me, your accounts receivables is outgrowing your revenue growth. You're not collecting money on these. And it's really weird because you're selling grills in December. Like, what's going on here, Al? Right. And he's like, holy shit. Like, they're exposing, you know.
Was that what happened to him?
Oh, yeah. What he did was Sunbeam called up like Home Depot and those companies and said, hey, it's accrual accounting. So you can sell a grill to somebody and put it on your revenue line, but never collect the cash. And it just goes on your accounts receivable.
Yeah, you just channel stuff.
And what did you say towards the beginning of this? It's all about beating on the revenue line, right?
Yeah.
So he would, and I think with him, he even got to the point where he said, you don't even have to take delivery. We'll just ship it to a warehouse and let it sit there.
Yeah.
But if you buy it in November and December, we're going to be able to put it on our revenue line and you're not out any cash. You just have a commitment to buy this thing at this price and receive delivery in the spring. And one of the analysts, I can't remember who it was like, hey, Al, like, how the hell are you selling grills in December? In Wisconsin.
They're all in Florida.
Yeah. And why is your accounts receivables so high all of a sudden?
Well, I hope that some of the listeners that are longs take some lessons out of this, because I think the due diligence that short sellers do is like really impressive. I don't know how y'all live. I think it's fucking crazy, to be perfectly honest. There's so much like market structure and timing stuff that I think it's like a very nerve-wracking pursuit. I don't know if it's worth the payoff, but I have mad respect for all you.
It's a passion, right? We're idealistic people. A lot of us are, I would put it on the spectrum slightly, right? Because we can sit there and read through every freaking filing and read every news report. And we don't mind everybody hating us.
Yeah, it's an interesting personality type that can take that kind of pain. Like public people just shaming you and the CEO comes after you and people want to believe that the CEO's right because there's so much money on the long side.
Oh, yeah.
Right, because on a lot of these things, it's billions of dollars on the line, right? And
right,
you're saying this is bogus.
But we believe in truth.
Yeah, that's right.
We passionately believe in truth, right? And you could see what people say to me sometimes on Twitter. Where, like, I mean, some of the longs of some of these tech bro stocks, they're nasty. They can be really nasty. And it was times where I'd be just like going through the fundamentals of the company, not even being mean to these people. And they'll call me a hard say word or attack me on my physical appearance or whatever kind of bullshit.
I did
they
see that
of.
Recently. And I thought
oh, yeah.
That was
yeah.
Super
I'm sure
weak.
That guy's a Tesla long who said that.
Yeah, I was not going to bring that up, but if you're listening, go fuck yourself.
Go fuck yourself, dude. He's also wearing like a banana hammock in his profile pic.
That's not, I was going to come at that guy. And then I was like, whatever, you're not worth the time. But yeah, that was weak. Yeah.
But it's what you see a lot from the bots, and especially from like the fanboys of certain companies, where I'm like, dude, I'm talking about metrics of a company and you're out here calling me the C word. Right. Yeah. It's like that to me is a red flag, where it's like if you get that mad over accounting, you got some issues going on.
Yeah. Well, it's a drop a Mark Ahotas thing. It's not what they call you. It's what you respond to. That's what his kid says. Right. And like when people get offended, if you don't like their stock, I think they got to look inside themselves and figure out what they're mad at.
Yeah. Well, Chano said one time,
because like if you're up big and you're pissed off that I'm saying something about your stock, like you should just be drinking champagne somewhere. Like,
exactly.
Who cares what I say?
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm just an idiot.
I'm one person. I could be totally wrong. And it's a stock guy. Like,
yeah,
it's
and
not-
like you're up and I'm not. So
yeah, exactly.
Go have fun.
Well, my favorite quote was when Chanos goes, you know, I've been called worse from better.
Yeah, there you go. That's
and I
right.
try to remind myself when people make personal attacks at me.
I do like that. Well, I know you got a flight to catch. I really appreciate you joining us. I hope that people like hearing from a short seller, and I was super happy to have you on the pod. So thank you.
Thank you. I was excited to be on this, and I look forward to people proving me wrong on related party transactions and oil price effect on the 2020 stock market.
Yeah, that's right. All the conspiracy people, don't come at me. It's all Jen Ross.
It is. And I'm sure people are heavily going to disagree with me on that, but I look forward to it.
All right, Jen. Well, take care of yourself.
Thank you. You too.